Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Mark Zitter, a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, chair of the Zetima Project, and your moderator for today's program. It's my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, Dr. Victoria Sweet, Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and author of the new book, Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing. In addition to her work at UCSF, Dr. Sweet is a prize-winning historian with a PhD in history. She practiced medicine for over 20 years at Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco, where she first began writing. Her first book, which was called God's Hotel, A Doctor, A Hospital, and A Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine, laid out some radically new ideas about medicine and healthcare in this country and won one of the California Book Awards here at the Commonwealth Club. Now, in her new book, Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing, she builds on those ideas, challenging what she says is the impersonal healthcare status quo. Dr. Sweet believes strongly that doctors must slow down, take the time to form connections with their patients, and carefully consider their patients' circumstances before the right diagnoses and treatments can be found. This is at least her fifth appearance at the Commonwealth Club. So please help me welcome back Dr. Victoria Sweet.
Thank you, Mike. Well, thank you very much, Mark, for agreeing to being a moderator here for me. And thank you all for being here. And thank you so much to the Commonwealth Club for having me here in this just beautiful new building. It's just fantastic. Feels really great. What we thought I would do today is spend about 10, 15 minutes sort of explaining how I got here. And a little bit how I got to some of my ideas. I'll read you a bit from my new book, and then we'll have mostly question and answers and comments from you. So first of all, let me have a sense of things, just so I know where you all are coming from. How many of you read God's Hotel? Okay, so quite a few, and some people haven't got to it yet. So for everybody, so basically I'm a doc. And I never considered myself a natural-born doc. So I wasn't the kind of person who went to school to become a doc. In fact, when I was a kid growing up, I never wanted to do anything. I didn't want to be a doctor. Nobody in my family was a doctor. And I didn't want to have anything to do with medicine. You know, those kids who wanted to see everything and see the owies and look at everything? Not me. I don't want to do that. I didn't volunteer in hospitals. I didn't even want to watch doctor shows. But what happened was, at the end of college, I went to Stanford, and at the end of college, I ran into the writings of Carl Jung, the psychiatrist, his memoir, Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. And I read it, and I realized, wow, this is what I want to be when I grow up. Because I loved the meaning he brought to his life and expected from his patients. And I loved the way he set up his life. Seeing well-paying, articulate, neurotic patients in the morning, and in the afternoon, studying alchemy and Chinese theory and illuminating medieval manuscripts. So that's what I decided to be, and that's why I got to medical school. But then it turned out I liked medical school a lot more than I thought I would, especially the two years. How many are there? Any docs? Good. Especially the last 2 years. So medical school's 4 years. You know, you do your undergraduate 4 years, and then you have 4 years of medical school. And they've changed things since I've been in school. But when I was in school, for the first 2 years, it was all the medical science. And then those last 2 years were finally when you get into the hospital and you start seeing patients. And I turned out I liked seeing patients much more than I thought I would. I liked the history. I liked talking to patients and hearing what they said and what they didn't say. Because there was so much psychology to it. You know, I really had to listen to what the patient said and didn't say. And then, as it turned out, I actually liked touching patients. I liked examining them because I found there was so much I could tell when I examined a patient about what they had and what they didn't have. And then I liked putting it all together and the diagnosis and the treatment and the plan. But I still started my original plan, which was to be a psychiatrist. But I was a little naive, and my psychiatric residency took place in the only locked ward in that particular county. So my patients did not turn out to be Jung's well-paying neurotic patients, but they were extremely psychotic, and it didn't take me long to realize that they responded much better to the medications I gave them than any talk therapy I tried. So then what I did is I got my license at the end of that first year, and I decided, you know what, maybe I like medicine. I think I'm just going to see whether I like medicine. I'm just going to go out and practice. And I ended up going out, and I ended up practicing for several years in community clinics and county clinics, and it turned out I loved it. I loved practicing in clinics. It's a lovely way to see patients because in county clinics, community clinics, you get everybody. You get the sick poor, but you also get all the immigrants. And I was particularly interested in how we'd get these wave of immigrants every time there was a war someplace in the world, or even just the rumor of a war. We'd get a wave of immigrants from that country in these clinics, and I would find out that they had a different way of looking at the body, that they had different diseases. So it was a very fascinating experience. In one of the clinics right near Stanford, just to give you an idea, I saw 3 cases of leprosy. I saw every parasite there is in the whole world and many unusual diseases and surprising cancers. So eventually, I decided to bite the bullet and I went back to do a residency in internal medicine, which is sort of being a real doctor in a way, which is 3 years. And I ended up doing here in the city at Kaiser in San Francisco in the middle of the AIDS epidemic. Sometimes I have to confess I feel a little bit like the Zelig of medicine that is also turning up when things were kind of going on, which was a fascinating also experience to deal with a new, infectious, contagious disease that had at the time no treatment. It was a very interesting and shocking experience. And then I went back after that to practice medicine in community clinics again, and eventually I really became more and more impressed by modern medicine, which I hadn't been impressed by when I started, by its method for arriving at a diagnosis and a treatment. But I also became more and more impressed by what modern medicine left out, which was anything that didn't fit its logical, mechanical model, really, of the body. And I thought for a while about learning Chinese medicine or Ayurvedic medicine, which were these different systems which looked at the body differently. But eventually I decided that even if I learned Chinese or Sanskrit, I'd still never understand these different ways of looking at the body from the inside of them. And it was at this really kind of discouraging moment in my life that I discovered serendipitously the writings of a woman who changed my life, whose name was Hildegard of Bingen. I discovered her writing about medicine by accident in the library. She turned out to have been a 12th century nun, an abbess, a mystic, but also a theologian, an artist, a composer, and a medical practitioner in the 12th century, which was, to recall you, at the time of Abelard and Heloise, Richard the Lionhearted, Henry II, Becket, and St. Bernard, to name just a few. So a very interesting time in history. And here's this woman I had no idea women did anything back then, really, honestly. And here I was reading in the library her book, which had just been translated from Latin to German and German to English, about her medical practice of the 12th century. And as I was reading it in the library, I was really taken aback. First of all, because it clearly wasn't this medicine, eye of newt, toe of frog medicine that I'd expected from a medieval medical text, you know, holy water and prayers. It was a real medicine for real patients with real diseases that I could recognize. But it was based on a different model of the body than my own methodical, mechanical model of the body. And it was a lot more like Chinese medicine, I thought, or Ayurvedic medicine. So I got really interested. In fact, I got kind of possessed. I decided I was going to figure this out. And for that, I had to go back to school and get a PhD in medieval and medical history. But I didn't want to stop practicing medicine because I love medicine. So I spent a couple of months looking around for a position where I could practice medicine part-time and go back to school and get a PhD in medical history with Hildegard of Bingen as my focus. It took me months at that time to find a part-time position. Finally, I discovered Laguna Honda, and they offered me a half-time position, and I went over there. I looked around, you know, the place, I don't know how many of you ever saw that old place, but it was wild. It looked, in fact, like a 12th century medieval monastery. At the time, it had 1,200 patients. It had 1,500 staff, a live-in priest, a visiting nun. It had an aviary. It had a greenhouse. And it had a little farm so that patients could pot plants, see chickens hatch from eggs, and even see animals, even if they were bedbound. So I ended up taking the job, but I was a bit worried about it, so I told the medical director I would come for 2 months, and I ended up staying for 20 years because the place was fascinating. And then I went back to school, meanwhile, and studied Hildegard of Bingen's medicine and kind of put the whole thing together. And I ended up writing a book about it because during the time I was there, Laguna Honda was discovered, as many of you know, by the Department of Justice, who was horrified by this old-fashioned place with patients on the open wards and chickens that visited the patients and little black pigs and a live-in priest. And the Department of Justice was shocked by the whole thing and insisted that San Francisco either rebuild a fancy new healthcare facility or tear the whole place down. And as many of you know here, it went on for years. There were speeches and organizations and bonds, but finally San Francisco did pass a huge bond, and Laguna Honda was rebuilt as a very beautiful, modern healthcare facility. And I took time off because I wanted to think about the medicine that I'd seen over the course of my life, where it was going, and also I wanted to write about Laguna Honda because I decided that I'd seen such things there that nobody would believe the kind of medicine I got to practice at that old place once the place was gone. So that's when I wrote God's Hotel. And God's Hotel ended up changing my life because it just took off. It's been my life since then. It's been 5.5 years since it came out, and it's all over the place. I've been all over the world. It's been translated into many different languages, and I've had this incredible opportunity to find out what's going on every place else, what's really going on. And I've also had the chance to listen, not just to speak to many, many audiences, but to listen to the audiences. And what I realized after several years is I was hearing the same thing in every audience I addressed. One person would get up and say the same exact sentence: "My doctor doesn't look at me anymore." And what I also found, which I found shocking, and what I also found as time went on, is there was also a sense that, well, why should the doctor look at me? Like, maybe we don't need that anymore. What this very disturbing sense that what was getting lost was, in the midst of this change as we went from medicine as a profession to healthcare as a commodity, where we went from doctors to healthcare providers and from patients to healthcare consumers, that this whole understanding that I developed over the many years that medicine is a relationship and that practicing medicine is actually a kind of, and nursing, is a spiritual practice. It was disappearing. So a couple of years ago, I decided I needed to write a book that really encapsulated my experience of how I went from not being a natural doctor and not really knowing anything about medicine to a place where I am now, where I think it's an incredible relationship on par with being a mom, being a dad, on par of these deep relationships, and that if we don't realize that and we don't understand, if that goes away, it's going to be hard to ever get back. So that's actually why I wrote this book, to encapsulate my experiences. So it's like God's Hotel, it's stories. They're the stories that really led me on this journey to where I am today. And so with that as an introduction, I'm going to read you just a little piece of it. And the piece I picked to read you happens in kind of the middle of my career, after I'd gone back to my residency, done my residency, I was finally out, I was finally fully trained, and I had gone back to this community clinic, which was a fantastic place, in the East Bay. It was beautiful, which is kind of surprising. You know, most of the community clinics started in little trailers. Very funky. The docs were free. They came out of the whole free clinic movement of the 60s, and a lot of them ended up getting money and building. And so this particular clinic was beautiful, and it had two floors, which is very unusual for a clinic. Downstairs, where the patients came, and the docs were, and the nurses were, and everything. There was a little ER we had, and we saw everything, everything, everything. And then upstairs were all the administrators. So there was kind of upstairs, downstairs, and this is a chapter from, I titled this chapter, Upstairs, Downstairs. So I started practicing downstairs as the doc, and then eventually the medical director left, and they actually asked me to be the medical director. So then I had this experience of practicing medicine downstairs and then going upstairs and being part of administration, which was very interesting for me. And what I'd like to read you is kind of give you a summary of a little bit of that experience. Upstairs turned out to be very different from downstairs. I had my own office with a view of the hills, an inbox and an outbox. It was predictable and pleasant. The upstairs staff came in late and left early, and only now and then, when a new regulation arrived or at budget time, did it erupt into activity. Most of the medical director's job was going to meetings, board meetings, staff meetings, consortium meetings. The attendees were mainly administrators, and the meetings seemed to be not so much meetings to accomplish something as meetings that constituted the job itself, which was how I met the head of District 22, who explained to me what those meetings were really about. I found myself walking out with him to our cars. It was a hot day on a treeless sidewalk. We started talking. I told him how, from a doctor's perspective, it was bureaucracy that was the problem. It took our time. I gave Mr. Mustique, one of my patients, as an example, the five calls I'd had to make to get him admitted to the hospital. The head of District 22 shook his head. No. The problem was that healthcare providers were going to have to learn to do more with less. I stopped walking. It was the first time I had ever heard the phrase healthcare provider. What? I asked. Huh? He stopped walking too. He turned and we faced each other. What's a healthcare provider? I asked him. What does that mean? He was thin and tall, and I couldn't see his eyes against the light. It's the doctors, he answered, and the nurses, and the hospitals, and the clinics. It's whoever provides healthcare. Healthcare providers. I was shocked. And the patients? The people who are sick? Who we take care of? What are they? They're healthcare consumers. That's ridiculous, I said. Patients are consumers? Like in a restaurant? They consume healthcare? They're healthcare consumers, he insisted. They choose to spend their money on healthcare. They buy it in the marketplace. They consume healthcare. My patients went through my mind. The heart attacks, the strokes, the cancers, the mental illness. My patients didn't choose to spend money on healthcare. They didn't have any money to spend, and then they got sick. Then they came to the clinic or the hospital and depended on me and mine to get them better. If anyone is a consumer, I told him, it's us, the doctors. We're the ones who consume resources, tissue paper and test tubes, silver and palladium, effort and energy. The head of District 22 stared at me for a second and then resumed walking. Healthcare providers, he repeated. Doctors are healthcare providers, and patients are healthcare consumers. It's the economic model. And that's where I think I'll stop.
Okay.
It's yours. Thank you.
Victoria, when I first received a copy, thank you. And by the way, question cards are welcome throughout. Although I'm going to ask a few of my own first to take moderator's privilege. But when I first received a copy of your book, and thanks to your publisher for that, I got it and I said, okay, slow medicine, I think I got what this is going to be about. It's going to be saying doctors should slow down, spend more time with patients. And it's also going to be critical of fast medicine, which is shuttling patients too fast through doctors' offices for economic reasons. But that wasn't really quite accurate and very simplistic. So could you first start by defining what you mean by slow medicine?
Maybe I should have done that at the beginning.
Well, so I'm covering for you.
Good, thank you. Very good. So slow medicine as a name is not just mine. A lot of docs came up with this around the same time, several years ago. And slow medicine is not slow. It's not fast.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fast medicine. It's really in opposition to the fast food model of healthcare, which is what we have today. That's how I look at it. And it really came out of the slow food movement in the same way that slow food is not really slow. It doesn't really take more time if you add up all the time necessarily. It's not its point. It's a different style. It's not fast food. And so it's an opposition to the fast food model. So slow medicine is more to do with style and with this idea that this fast food model where we think of healthcare as being some kind of retail commodity on a shelf that somebody can just take off and you can dicker for it and we're buying and selling there is a completely wrong-headed model. That's what it is. And so the slow, I play a lot with the slow in the book because there is a way in which it's a different style,
mm-hmm.
right? If you do slow down, you actually have more time. It's the principle of relativity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's built in, actually, to Western culture. There is a Latin phrase, festine lenitor. It goes back to Roman times. Rush slowly.
Say more about that.
It's very interesting. I become kind of a slow person. And I say this because I was always a flat, fast person. In fact, one of my brothers-in-laws used to say about my entire family that we had the time, we didn't have the time to do it right, but we had the time to do it over.
Mm-hmm.
Which I took to heart, actually. And what I have found was that when I literally slow down, like just, it's almost like you have time and you can just stretch time out. You can have the same amount of time. And I'll give you a specific medical example of this. This is really, so you can stretch time out. Time is not time.
Mm-hmm.
I can really go all over the place with this. I'll tell two stories now. Is that right?
Okay, if they're quick.
Oh, huh? If they're quick?
They're pretty quick. Yeah.
Okay, I gotta tell.
I gotta tell a
slow medicine story fast. Well, for one thing, in the Middle Ages, they didn't have clocks, okay? We have these clock things. And they didn't have clocks in the Middle Ages. They had bells, right? They rang the bells. And the way they divided, I love this, the way they divided their time, their 24 hours, it's not actually natural the way we think about time, okay? We think about time as like seconds, like that, and it's just, what do you mean it's distensible, Dr. Sweet? That's crazy. It just takes a certain amount, and it's all in, done by atoms now, and it just takes, that's just how it is, but it isn't. So in the Middle Ages, what they did is they divided their day into 24-hour days, 12 hours of night and 12 hours a day, regardless of the time of year, so that you always woke up at 6 in the morning, and you always had dinner at 6. But in the winter, your hours were more like 45 minutes of our hours. Does that make sense? Everybody gets how that would work?
Mm-hmm.
So in the winter, from our point of view, we have like 10 hours of sunlight, right? And we have 14 hours of dark from our atomic way of looking at it. But in the Middle Ages, they said, we just divided light into 12 sections, yeah? So you'd have 12 hours. So at night, when you would sleep at night in winter, you might sleep for 8 hours, but those 8 hours would actually be an hour and a half. Each hour was an hour and a half long. Does that kind of make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second one, the medical slow medicine piece, I'll get to it, is that there was an interesting study that really affected me. It was about 20 years ago. And they did a study where it was in a hospital. They had, this was post-surgical, they wanted to see how distensible time was in a way. So they did an experiment where your doctor would come by the room of a certain group of patients and stand at the doorway for exactly 5 minutes. I don't know how they did it. They buzzed him, or that the patient in the bed didn't know that. And talk with the patient from the doorway for 5 minutes. And then they had another doc with the other group of patients, or the same group of patients, come by and come into the room and stand a little way from the bed and also talk to patients for 5 minutes. And then they had another group of docs come to the patients and sit on the bed for 5 minutes. And then in the afternoon of the experiment, they came by and they asked the patient, gee, did you see your doc today? How long was he here? And the one where the doc stood by the doorway said, yeah, I think I did. I don't know. He just came in because he was here for a couple of minutes. The patient doc who came in the room, the patient said, oh, he was here for about 5-10 minutes. The doc who sat on the bed said, oh, we had a great talk. He was here for like, I don't know, 20 minutes. So that actually got, this is sort of the essence of the matter. By sitting down, by having an actual face-to-face relationship with somebody, you can have a lot of time. You can make 15 minutes be very long, and you can have a very successful visit. But if you're sitting on the computer the entire time for the same amount of time, even if you're sort of attending to the patient, the patient's not going to feel listened to. It might as well not have even have happened.
Mm-hmm. So slow medicine is partly about time, but it's partly about style and the way you think about it overall. Now, the other part of my assumption that was wrong when I first got the book was about fast medicine, that fast medicine was only about speed, number one. And number two is that you were completely opposed to fast medicine.
Yeah.
But you're not. Say more about what is fast
medicine. I'm also playing around with these things a little bit because I actually have three different sort of levels. So there's that, the first piece, which is stretching time out, and that is a style. And then the second, the fast food, slow medicine is the opposite of fast food. But there's a way in which I talk about fast medicine as a model of the body. Mm-hmm. Because the model of fast medicine is a model of the body as a machine and the doctor as a mechanic. And it's a model that came out, that began to be really important in the 19th century. And this was the idea that the role of the doctor was to find what's broken and fix it or replace it. It's logical, it's methodical, and it has been incredibly successful. I mean, nobody would want to go back to the different model of body upon which you could say slow medicine was based, which is much more of a medieval model, which is the model of the body as a plant. And the doctor is a gardener and somebody who removes what's in the way of the body's natural healing.
Mm-hmm.
So that level of fast medicine is this very successful level that's logical, that's methodical, that breaks things down into their component parts and fixes them. And where it works great. And where it doesn't work at all. Mm-hmm. And we need to be able to distinguish them and have both styles, the style of slow, the style of fast, the body as plant, the body as machine. We need to be able to pull those out and use them like tools in a little black bag when's appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, it's appropriate if you have an acute appendicitis. Mm-hmm. I don't want my doctor to act like a gardener when I have acute appendicitis. Mm-hmm. I want him to send me to the CT, examine me, fix it, take it out. But afterwards, mm-hmm. as before that happens, then it's not appropriate to continue that model of body as machine and continue to do things to try and fix things where what you need to do is fix the environment around the patient and allow their natural healing to take place. So we need both of these styles.
So fast medicine is not just about scientific Western medicine. There's, no. You can have slow medicine within that as well.
That's right.
And fast medicine is not always wrong, but it applies. We've over-applied it, perhaps.
Yes, we have. We just applied it. Whatever. It makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense because it was so dramatic. Within like 5 years, around from about 1875 to 1880, this whole idea kind of happened. And it was just a dramatic change to start, because one of the reasons we get progress, when we have a logical, methodical way of saying, wow, this medicine doesn't work, we can move on. So it was dramatic, but I think we've overdone it.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Your book is full of wonderful stories and anecdotes that illustrate your points, and you credit a lot of your mentors for some of the things you've learned along the way. One person you mentioned is Dr. Greg.
Yes.
And among many things you mentioned about him, he taught you that, quote, every time we do something to a patient, we also undo something. What does that mean?
Well, Dr. Greg was really a wonderful man. He was a mentor. I was very young, so he was, you know, an older gentleman who was very doctorly, and he wore his white coat and his tie, and he was really an interesting guy, and he was very experienced. And so he was the attending when I was on medicine as a medical student, and I loved him. And the last day I was on that service, he was getting into the elevator. He would come by in the mornings and see our patients and help us figure them out. And so I held the elevator door open as he was getting in. It would be the last time I would ever see him. And I said, did he have anything to tell me, a young medical student, any word of wisdom he could give? And he said, yes. He said, every time, he said, basically what happens with patients is a third of the time they get better, a third of the time they get worse, and a third of the time they stay the same. And all we do is change who does what. And then he was holding the elevator door, and he let it go, and the elevator door closed, and he went away. But I never forgot that, because it fascinated me, this concept, and I kept wanting to know whether it was true. So for the last 40 years, for every study I've ever looked with, mostly had a placebo group, which I thought of as the Dr. Greg group. This is the group that didn't get the thing. And I have kept track for the last 40 years, and Dr. Greg is basically right. About a third of the time, if you look at the placebo group, about almost exactly a third of the time, the patients get better from just about anything. It's quite amazing. And a third of the time, they stay the same. A third of the time, they get worse, and so do the people in the group for which we're using medications. Now, of course, sometimes it's worth it. Like, it's worth it to run the risk for the extra. I mean, usually there's a bit extra that you get from giving a medication, and sometimes, of course, it's very dramatic, the difference. But most of the time, he was right. And so the undoing doing thing is that, you know, when we give patients a medication, it's not just doing something to the patient. It's countering something the body's doing. So we're undoing something the body's doing. And I'll give you an example that I think about a lot, and that is about the statins. Mm-hmm. So the cholesterol-lowering medicines, statins, that approximately 38% of you are on, for lowering cholesterol. The idea is if we lower cholesterol, we will prevent heart attacks and strokes. There's evidence for that, not terrific, but good enough. But as it turns out, if you look at those studies, for every patient has one less heart attack, the original study, it's amazing, one person commits suicide, homicide, or accidental death. Really bizarre, right? I mean, that's a pretty bizarre outcome. And for years when I read the first few studies, which was in the 80s about this, I'm going like, because if you have to look down, you have to search for where the placebo group, like, so you add up and you go like, oh, wow, because what they advertise is like, 20 fewer, you know, deaths from heart attacks. But you have to go look in the placebo group and go, wow, the placebo group and the guys on statins had the same number of deaths. So if there were fewer heart attacks in the statin group, what was more? Well, it turned out what was more is homicide, suicide, and accidental death, which seemed like ridiculous. But then I started thinking about it, and I thought, well, what does cholesterol do in the body? What is it that statins are undoing? Well, it turns out cholesterol is like your body's made out of cholesterol. Your brain, the white matter of your brain, it's white because it's cholesterol. Okay? It lines your nerve cells. Your body makes vitamin D out of cholesterol. Your body makes our sex hormones out of cholesterol. So that's what I mean by every time we have to consider that, every time we do something, we're undoing something else. And so it's not straightforward. And as patients, we all need to really look at that placebo group.
Mm-hmm. Now, you point out, you mentioned that that sometimes, though, the medication is very dramatic.
And yes,
you worked
absolutely.
The AIDS epidemic, look what's happened since
oh,
then.
Oh, amazing.
Forth. Do you think it's fair to say that it's that your third is perhaps a better model for milder diseases, longer-term chronic things than something very serious like an AIDS or a hepatitis C?
Well, I think you're willing to take a lot more risk if you're dying of AIDS, right? Mm. I mean, actually, you know, now, of course, it's all... I mean, it's amazing what's happened with HIV. Mm. Amazing. But when we first started using AZT, it seemed very dramatic. But one of the things is we didn't have a placebo group.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was so dramatic, we had this stuff, and we just wanted to use it because we had nothing. So between nothing and something, we just used it. We didn't really have a placebo group, ever, with AZT in specific. I think now it's you just can't get away from the fact that it's just absolutely amazing about HIV/AIDS. Nevertheless, there's a lot of side effects that go along with those drugs.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yes. Absolutely. There's a kind of an obvious question that comes up for me, and it's come up with some of the audience questions too, and that is that I think most people here and most people in America would generally like to support your notion of slow medicine, but it's not being practiced, not because people don't like it, because right. we have sort of a financial model, maybe a cultural model, but mostly a financial model that doesn't really support it. So if I can kind of combine some of these questions, is how can doctors change that? How can patients try to encourage receiving slow medicine? Mm-hmm. We even have someone in the room who's apparently in the healthcare business side, management side, and said, what can business professionals in medicine do to support slow medicine?
It's great. Thank you for those questions. Those are great. So one of the things I learned at Laguna Hanan in my life as a doc is what I call the efficiency of inefficiency. And what I mean by that is a lot of the onerous bureaucracy that's been laid on docs and nurses and nurse practitioners, physicians, assistants, and everybody over the last 20 years in an attempt to save money has apparently cost money, right? In the purpose of trying to get efficient, we've actually become inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of a general concept, but a more specific concept is in terms of slow medicine, if we all are willing to believe that we can stretch time out if we're not stressed and we actually have enough time, and we don't fill it with unnecessary things, the amount of time that doctors are actually scheduled with patients mm-hmm. has not changed. It actually has changed a little bit, to be honest. It's actually gone from about 15 minutes to 12 and a half minutes. But let's just say on the average, it depends where you are. About 15 minutes forever. It's been 15 minutes, 4 patients an hour. So we used to have enough time, and now we don't.
Mm-hmm.
So what are we doing with the time? It's a little bit like a slow medicine approach to the problem and asking, what's in the way of doctors having the time? Well, it turns out it's very simple. What are the doctors doing with the 15 minutes of their time? They're sitting in front of their computer entering healthcare data. That's what they're doing with their time. And that's not me just saying that. There's been studies. Stanford did a study about 6 years ago and asked the question, how much time are our doctors spending on the computer? They were spending 70% of their time on the computer. And then Kaiser did a study that I heard about through the grapevine, an informal study, because all their doctors were whining that they didn't have any time with their patients. And Kaiser said, well, how much time are they spending on the computer? Let's find out. I know. We'll just take 2 hospitals, and we'll just follow all the doctors' keystrokes for 2 months, and we'll count the seconds of all that time, and we'll divide it by the number of doctors, and then we'll know how much time our doctors are spending on the computer. And so they did that. And it turned out that in an 8-hour day, their doctors were spending 10 hours on the computer. That's true. That's true. Everybody I know, all the docs, they nod their heads when I come to that. They nod their heads because they all go home, and from 8 to 10, they work on their computers. So where's our time going? We have enough time. We're wasting our time. Mm-hmm. We're wasting all of our time on the computer. Why are we wasting all our time on the computer? Wasting all the time on the computer because we have these electronic medical records that were incredibly poorly designed. Nobody came to a doc and said, what do you like about your old-fashioned paper charts and what don't you like? Actually, they did. I have to say, in fact, they did come to several of us because I was actually asked to consult my one and only consulting job by a Japanese company 20 years ago who was planning on doing electronic medical records. And their idea was before they designed the records, they would actually talk to doctors and find out what doctors would want. So I was just there for like 8 hours, but I was incredibly impressed with their questions. They'd hired a psychologist and an anthropologist, and they had doctors from private hospitals and clinics, and it was a fascinating thing to think about. What would I want an electronic medical record to do? I was like, great. First of all, it drives me crazy. I have to call the labs for my values. That's just, I want them to appear. All the labs, the x-rays, the tests, the consults, I want them to appear on the computer, right? I'd like that. But what, then they asked, well, what do you like about your paper charts? I said, I really love these paper charts because they look like a book. They're a book. And I get to write in them. And I get to think. And I get to see what other people have written. And since I know everybody's handwriting at a place like Laguna Honda, I knew exactly who'd written just by looking at the handwriting and whether I could believe what they said or not. So they listened. They did this fabulous thing. It went on for months, and the Japanese company finally decided that it was impossible, and they never got into it. So in the meantime, there was people taking the computer program that already existed, which was, I think it came out of the 80s, was a computer program for billing. Started very gradually. It was just a billing program. We all hand-wrote our notes. First, it was just a piece of paper that was generated. We checked the billing codes. Then they put it on the computer, and that is what turned into the electronic medical records today. And it's terrible. And it doesn't have to be terrible. And I want my time back with patients. So that's where our time is, and that's what anybody in healthcare business can help us do. We need, I think of it as an electronic paper chart. Mm-hmm. We need a chart that lives in the cloud, that's accessible to anybody who wants it, and the patient allows it. And it looks like a book, and it's made out of electricity. Mm-hmm. But I can write in it, and I can dictate, and I can type it into it. And then when I'm done with it, I can put it back up there, and I can take it out, and I can turn the pages. And it already exists, that technology. And I don't know why we don't have it.
It's difficult, and you and I were talking backstage about this, about certainly the number one frustration doctors have is the time they have to spend with electronic documentation. By the way, we have a program on December 7th next week here about physician burnout, and I'm sure a key issue, maybe the key issue, you're talking about medical records as
absolutely. Well. Absolutely. If we can make that go away, we would really be able to have the fast and the slow together a lot. I mean, there's still other things to do, but that's the low-hanging fruit. That should be easy to do.
And you and I discussed, it's not easy to do, I can promise you that, because it hasn't been done. It seems like it should be. And you and I have discussed about how, of course, the initial medical records were based on billing systems. That's why they put them together in the first place, tried to put clinical issues on top of that, and it clearly hasn't worked very well. You even have the situation where people actually hire, medical centers hire scribes to write while the doctor can look at the patient.
That's right.
Which is not where we want to be. And that's certainly not, that's some of the fast medicine. That we're trying to avoid.
I keep thinking, I've been asked that at some of the talks, what I think about that. And, I mean, if that's what we have to do, it's better than what we have. But I keep thinking of it, it's like having this badly designed car that doesn't drive that you've now attached a horse to. Mm. So the horse can now pull the car. It's like, why not fix it?
Yeah. Big system. They're trying. I want to talk about a few other things you mentioned in the book. Very interesting stuff. And you wrote a couple of places about using drugs in ways they weren't officially approved for and so forth. Dr. Howard, you mentioned, used Thorazine, which is a powerful antipsychotic, to reduce blood pressure because he had an emergency and that's all he had. And you used Narcan, which is for addiction issues, for a patient who otherwise would have coded and had a heart attack. So is that part of slow medicine, and how do you figure out in what circumstances to go against the grain in that regard?
Well, that is part of the art of medicine. So one of the things I also was really interesting for me to write this particular book because, as any of you, I'm sure many of you are writers, you learn a lot when you write something. And one of the things I realized is that, medicine is a science, but it's also a craft and it's also an art. And some things belong to the science and some things are part of the craft. And the best doctors are all of those things. They're scientists and they're craftsmen and they're artists. Mm-hmm. And using medicines for their side effects, being aware of their side effects and using them and creating, the most elegant, smallest set of medications for your patient is a really sort of, what would it be, I won't say fun thing to do, but it's challenging. It's a satisfying thing to do. So I'll give you some examples. Just in general, at Laguna Honda, one of the things about my patients in particular, because they were so sick, On average, the average patient came to Laguna Honda on between 15 and 26 medications. And because I had enough time there, because we were over the hill to the poorhouse, and for a long time nobody paid attention to us, and I could actually really do the medicine I learned, I could do a full history and really examine the patient, and take my time finding out what the patient really had and review everything. I had the time to look at all those medications and look at the diagnoses and take people off medications to see if they needed the medications, mm-hmm. and then to mess around with the medications, to use a medication, let's say, whose side effect I wanted. And the example I'll give you that just comes to mind would be with the antipsychotics, for instance. I don't know how many of you know about. So for people who are psychotic with manic depression or schizophrenia, the classic ones, we have a whole sheaf of medications. They have all kinds of side effects. So one of the side effects of many of them is weight gain. So that's a bad side effect, except for people who need to gain weight. So if I had a patient who was a bit paranoid and who came in really skinny and the nurses couldn't get him to eat, and I have a choice between giving him an antipsychotic that makes him hungry or an antipsychotic who has a side effect of making them not hungry, I could choose the one who makes them hungry and get two for the price of one. That's what I mean.
Yeah. And, of course, there have been some notable, sometimes hilarious examples in this clinical trials where a blood pressure medication fails, but it gives men erections and it becomes Viagra.
They're perfect.
Right? Yeah.
Perfect.
It's true.
So, no, that is true. Yeah. Actually, the one that really stuck in my mind about this was, there was a while I was on one of the wards at Laguna Honda that I was just covering it. So I there were like 35 patients on a ward, and because I was just covering it, the patients were all new to me. So, you know, like anything else, you get a new look. And they were mostly guys in their, it was a ward of men, and they were demented, and they were anywhere between the ages of like 35, some of them, and 104. But they were mostly in their 50s and 60s. And I'm walking down this ward, and I'm going like, wow, these guys have the best eyelashes I have ever seen. What is that? I'd never seen eyelashes like that, right? I mean, they were like thick old eyelashes. It wasn't everybody, but it was like a lot of them. And I was going like, I wonder what that could be. So I went through their chart, and I found that they were all being prescribed this new glaucoma drug, all of those people. And I call up my mom. I said, Mom, I have figured out a way to make $1 trillion, and I wish I cared about money because I should do this. This drug, I'm convinced, makes your eyelashes grow. So that's the one that they've been using. So, of course, I didn't do it because I don't do any of these ideas. But in fact, they did realize that, and that's the medicine they're now using to, when you go to your plastic surgeon and they give you drops to put on your eyelids, that's what they're using, is this glaucoma drug.
So we're learning things along the way. That's funny. We have a question from the audience about how medical school can change to enhance the delivery of slow medicine.
Oh, medical school. So the good news about medical school is it's really great, and it's way better than it was when I was in school, I think. They do not make the students wait for years. They have a lot more respect for the medical students, and I think the medical students in general that they pick are just wonderful people. They're going out of their way, at least at the ones I've met, at UCSF and many places I've spoken. The medical schools, that whole generation of kids, they're fantastic people. They're not sexist. They're not racist. They don't even get it, right? It's like amazing. So we've got this, I think, a new and improved medical school. We've got these great students. What's the problem? The problem is the students get these great lectures. They're encouraged to be humanists. They're encouraged to listen to people, not to be all these things, to think, all these great things. Then they go into the hospital, and they all tell me. They go in the hospital, and nobody is looking at the patient. They're all looking at their computer. That's all they see all the time. And they're really upset about it. There was one guy in particular, he said he was just about ready to quit, mm-hmm. because he couldn't see how he was ever going to do what he wanted to do. And I've had that from many medical students. So if we don't fix the records problem, it seems silly, right? It can't be that easy to just fix the medical records problem, and then all these great things will happen. And I don't think it's the only thing, but I think it's the low-hanging fruit. If we don't fix that, then everything we tell medical, we're actually creating a R.D. Langian double bind. Mm-hmm. We're saying, you need to be a wonderful person. You need to listen to your patient, look them in the eye, examine them, think about things, be a humanist. And you have to be on the computer all of your time. And that'll drive people nuts.
just can't work.
Yeah, so that's where I would start. Once we've got that fixed, I do have some other ideas.
Oh, good, 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 good. At one point in the book, you talk about seeing a patient who you realize is what you call past the point of no return.
Yeah.
What's the point of no return, and what should you do as a doctor when you have such a patient?
That was probably the hardest patient I may have ever had in my life. And I this was a particular patient in when I was an intern who was this lovely woman. She was in her early 70s, and she came in because of chest pain. She'd had a history of chronic lymphocytic lymphoma, which is a leukemia, which is a disease you can have for a long time, like 10, 15 years. She had an oncologist. She was taking a very simple medicine, and she was doing pretty well. The cancer didn't seem to be growing. She came in with chest pain. And she ended up being my patient in the ICU for 63 days because we just couldn't, the oncologist could not figure out what was wrong with her, and she just kept getting worse and worse, and he kept doing more and more tests and biopsies and this is and that, and I was the intern. And as the intern, you don't really have any power. You don't have any power to say this is crazy. You just really have to do it. So I'm doing all the drawing her bloods, and she's spiking her for 6 days, and I watched her deteriorate. And because he was the methodical, logical, body's a machine, there's something broken, I just haven't found it yet, he would not give that up. And I couldn't give it up, so I was just doing what he said, and she was just literally disintegrating. Her hair was falling out, her teeth fell out. She was just disintegrating in front of me. And finally, one of the ICU nurses called me to the side and took me into the nurse's break room on the ICU and sat me down and said, "What are you doing to Mrs. Carmona?" And I'm like, "Well, we're trying to figure out what's wrong with her so we can give her the right treatment and get her out." And she looked at me and she said, "Mrs. Carmona is never leaving this ICU. She's never getting out of here. She's not going out in a wheelchair. She's not going out in a gurney. She's never, ever going to lift her grandchildren again. She's past the point of no return." And I didn't know about what that meant, but I did now, which was that there's a place at which your body can't recover. Your body's amazing. It's amazing. But there is a place in that cycle where once you get to that point, you're never going to be able to come back, and you have to recognize that. And at that point, you have to be able to say, it doesn't matter if the family's asking for everything. It doesn't matter if the patient's asking for everything. You have to actually have the conversation where you sit down and say, you've passed the point of no return. You're not going to get better. Then I'm not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why. And this is what we can do instead.
And that requires some courage on the doctor's part.
Yeah, I suppose.
Well, why don't most doctors do that? I guess maybe I should ask it as a question.
Well, you first have to kind of decide that you agree with that statement that I said, that there is a point of no return. So I would say I think a lot of doctors probably would disagree with me.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not, but I have a feeling a lot of docs would say, no, there's never a point. If somebody's alive, we can. There's things we can do. There's always something we can do. So I think a lot of docs just really, again, going back to how I started this, you know, telling you a bit about myself, I never was a natural-born doctor, whatever I mean. I mean, I just wasn't. So I've always had a large amount of skepticism and kind of this nature-healing heresy, it used to be called, that, you know, basically, your body's more amazing than anything, and it doesn't surprise me there'd be a point of no return.
Mm-hmm.
So if we take the mechanical model of the body, I expect that those docs have a firm mechanical model of the body. I mean, you have a car. You could say that if you get the right mechanic, there is no car you can't fix.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But if you look at a plant, you look at that, but we've got a fern right now who my partner does not want to admit that this fern has passed the point of no return. And I'm not going to let her live, but this fern is past the point of no return, but I haven't explained that to her yet. So
you got to take her into that ICU break room for that one.
That's very good.
You have an interesting story in the book about a patient with asthma getting traditional treatment, just not getting better,
yeah.
not getting better. And somehow you run into somebody who knows something about Eastern medicine and talks about the yin and the yang and something that a lot of people would think is ridiculous. But you invite that person to participate in treatment and the patient recovers.
Yeah.
So I'd like to say both a little bit about that and also Did you include that example in the book as an example of where Western medicine just doesn't know everything? Mm. Was it an anti-fast medicine example? What mm-hmm. point do you think that makes?
So this was very interesting. So this was the part of my career I'd done my medical school, I'd done my internship, but I hadn't done that next piece of residency, and I was out there in these community clinics practicing medicine, and I was pretty impressed by modern medicine. I'd learned it well, and I was willing to keep learning it, and asthma is pretty simple, relatively simple to treat, and this was actually a friend of mine who got asthma, and it just got worse and worse, and I was trying methodically all the things I learned to do, one after another. We gave her inhalers, I gave her the pills, you know, I ended up putting a bottle of epinephrine in her refrigerator. I mean, she didn't have health insurance. Of course, people didn't way back then. She didn't have health insurance, so she didn't really have any money, and I was trying to, she just got worse and worse and worse. Finally, she got so bad she had to be admitted to the general hospital. She was there for 3 or 4 days. They pumped her full of steroids. They finally got her out, but she wasn't really better. She was just good enough to get discharged. And I didn't quite know what to make of it, to be honest. I was like, wow. I mean, she was my friend, too. So, it just so happened that very weekend I had scheduled a retreat for myself, and I went on the retreat, and it turned out that my roommate was a very interesting-looking woman, but it was a silent retreat, so I couldn't find out about her till the end of the weekend. And so we're all packing up, and at the end of the weekend, we start talking, and I go, what do you do? And she says, well, I'm a practitioner of this particular school of Chinese medicine. This was a long time ago when Chinese medicine was just coming in, but it wasn't like the most obvious thing in the world. And she started explaining to me about this whole new system. This is the first time I'd heard of this system of the yin and the yang, and qi coursing your body. And I knew about acupuncture as a thing, but I didn't understand how it all worked. So she explained to me rather briefly the whole thing, and she explained that in Chinese medicine, that's how she explained it, that they didn't see your body is made up of little cells that, you know, have broken parts or diseases like that. It was more of this flow of energy through the body, and that disease happened when things got blocked up. And qi could back up and cause a dysfunction of your lungs, or distally it would dry up and your kidneys wouldn't work. So I asked her, you know, it was this sort of idea of hot and cold and wet and dry and fluid. So I asked her whether it had an idea about asthma. And she said, oh, yeah, asthma, definitely asthma. She explained it. There's parts that block up. And I said, can you treat asthma? And she says, oh, yeah, we treat it this way. So I was like, thought of my friend, Lee, and I asked her. She was on her way to the airport. I asked her to stop at the house on the way home. I want to see. So she came in. I had Lee over. And it was fascinating to watch her. Talk about slow medicine. I didn't have a concept of it. But, you know, she just sat, and she just looked at Lee for a while. She didn't take a history. She didn't ask her anything. She just looked at her. And then she took her wrists, and she took her pulse. You know, everybody's familiar with this now, but back then it was interesting for me to watch. She took her pulse for a couple of minutes. She looked at her tongue. And she didn't listen to her heart. She didn't have a stethoscope. She didn't do anything. She didn't know her meds, nothing. She goes like, ah, yes, you have too much yin. Not enough yang. So she prescribed this whole treatment with daikon radish tea 4 times a day, and three umeboshi plums, and Lee had to eat nothing but brown rice for 10 days, and she had to go off all of her medications, all of them, immediately, because synthetic medications were yin. So I'm listening, and I go like, okay, and so she leaves, and Lee does this. I was a little skeptical about stopping her medication, so I insisted that she taper herself off over about a day. But really, within at least a day and a half, I could just tell she was better. And within 2 days, her whole stance had changed. It was remarkable. And she did brown rice for 10 days and umeboshi plums and daikon radish tea. And by the end of the 10 days, we were able to add back in yang foods, I can explain that later. Yang foods, and that was the end of that. And that stuck in my mind totally about having a different model for the body. So why did I put it in there? Well, it's partly because It did happen at that time, but also because it was a real one of these turning points that happens to you when I was like, wow, there are different ways of looking at the body, and some of them work for certain diseases, and some of them don't work for certain diseases. And I didn't know whether what she did would work in all patients with asthma or why it worked, but I started to be open to, is there these other ways, which then I would learn from Hildegard, even the West had another way to look at the body, that we could pull out of my black bag and not just look at patients with one way, but have a second way to also look at, and maybe even a third.
So this person suggested two things. One was the daikon radish tea and the umeboshi plums, and I'm going to have to try one of those at some point. But also
salty.
Had stop all the Western medicine.
Yeah.
Right? And it's hard to tell which, if it was the combination of both those things that helped or one or the other.
Well, I would never tell somebody who's taking asthma to stop their medication. So I don't think this was a case, given the nature of asthma medicines and how we think about asthma, that it was a side effect of the medications. My hypothesis, my sort of Western medicine hypothesis, was wondering whether it was a milk allergy. Because we were all being vegetarians back then, and Lee had become a vegetarian. And when you're a vegetarian, you end up eating a lot of dairy products. And, of course, when she was on the brown rice, she didn't ever have dairy products again. I wondered, because if there's so much stuff in our food, like there's penicillin that they gave the cows, it gets in the milk, you have a penicillin allergy. So for about 6 months, I had all my asthma patients, I tried to get them to go off dairy products. Mm-hmm. And there have been studies since then that look like dairy products can definitely contribute to certain people's asthmas. So that may be it. But I prefer to think that actually she had too much yin.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Now, it's worth noting, most major medical societies these days over the last number of years have stopped recommending that people get annual physicals because they just don't find the evidence for them. You say in your book that you believe in doing them even though you're aware of that evidence.
Mm.
And it raised the question for me, what should the role of scientific evidence be in medical practice?
Well, first of all, let me just sort of say, to be clear, I don't believe necessarily in annual physical exams for healthy people.
Mm-hmm.
When I believe in physical exams when people come to me, that I want to examine them.
Yep.
That's what it is. I want to examine them. In fact, I'd rather examine you than know anything else about you, even than talk to you, really. I'd rather this whole telehealth and this kind of stuff make me crazy, mm-hmm. because I just don't see how I can figure you out if I can't look you in the face and we share our common aura and smell you and take your pulse myself and do the blood pressure myself if there's something wrong with you.
Mm-hmm.
By contrast, I'm not sure that seeing a doctor when you're not sick is a good idea. I really think it may be a mistake, honestly. I think you should go to your grandmother as much as possible and ask your grandmother what you should do when you get the cold, and you should gargle with salt water for the sore throat, and you should take mint tea when your stomach's upset. So I think back to the efficiency and what, you know, how we can get our time back, I think a tremendous amount, probably 50% of what we do is preventative, and it's public health measures, and it's all this kind of stuff, and it's, I'm not sure it's really worth, the game's worth the candle. That's a whole other discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of evidence-based medicine, I love evidence-based medicine. I like it if it's really based on evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So the biggest problem with our evidence-based medicine now is that most of our studies are run by pharmaceutical companies,
mm-hmm.
and they hide the results of the actual results. They hide them. I'm sorry if I'm insulting anybody here from the pharmaceutical industry, but it's been very upsetting because they hide them and they exaggerate the evidence. And let me give you one example. I've got 3 minutes, but I'll give you one. Maybe, shall I give an example?
Give a quick.
I'll try and give a quick example, but I was just struck by this. So this was about a month ago. The New England Journal of Medicine, the premier journal of medicine that internal medicine docs like me read, had an article on comparing the use of aspirin and a very fancy digoxycline. I can't even pronounce it. It's Zalexto. It's one of those things where they marketing wanted to have an X and a Z because those make medicines very effective. Mm. So they have an X and a Z in the same name, and I can't pronounce it. But anyway, it's Xarelto. And Xarelto costs like $1 million, and there's aspirin. And they compared the two for incidence of strokes in AFib. And it was clear if you actually go and you actually looked at the numbers of patients, it worked like this. If 100 patients took the Xarelto for 6 months and 100 patients took aspirin, which cost nothing, that two patients in the Xarelto group had a stroke and three patients in the aspirin group, okay? And they put that together as they say it decreased your risk by 30%. Sounds like a lot, right? But in fact, that's the evidence, right? So everybody should be taking Xarelto because it's so much better than aspirin by 30%. But the real answer is it's actually your relative risk, and it means that 100 people have to take a medicine that not just costs a lot of money, but 100 people are going to get the side effects of that medicine, right? And maybe one person doesn't have a stroke, and then if you add them up, you go, well, what are the side effects? Turns out for every person that didn't get the stroke, one person had a major GI bleed. So you're, Jen, back to Dr. Greg, you're trading off who gets what. So one person doesn't get a stroke, but somebody else has a major GI bleeding in the hospital and has to get transfused and maybe dies. So That's what I have to say on that.
Always look at medicine. Okay. Well, we've got time for one very quick question, and that's just this one. Given how hard it is to practice slow medicine in the current environment, what do you recommend to people considering a career in medicine?
That's a good question.
Thank you.
What I recommend for people considering a career in medicine is that I think being a doctor is just amazing. I do. I think it's fantastic. So I'll start with that. I'm hoping that if you started now, by the time you actually have to practice, we will have fixed these problems. No, really. That's what I'm hoping. So I'm encouraging people to do it. And in the meantime, you know, if I hear from a medical student, gee, I'm in my second year, I want to practice slow medicine, what do I do? It's all, everybody's on the computer. I tell them to go to Africa for a month or two or three because they won't have CT scans and they will have to practice slow medicine. They'll have to examine the patients. They'll have to do the doctor. They'll have to just manage, or to go out into rural America where it's the same situation.
Great. Okay. We'll leave it at that. Our thanks to Dr. Victoria Sweet, Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. She's also author of the new book, Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing. We want to thank everyone here in San Francisco, as well as our audiences on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Mark Zitter of the Zetima Project, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.
Woo-hoo.